month. Hello, welcome. Episode 52 of the Clippings Podcast. We are reviewing nail papers and sharing them with you. I'm April Schachtel, and I am joined by my co-host,
Jasmine Rana.
We are so excited to be back with you this evening, and we're going to be covering two recent nail papers of significant impact for you today on the podcast. I'll go first. I'm going to dive in with my study, which is a brief report published in October 2024 in JAMA Dermatology. Title is Low-Dose Naltrexone Use in Biopsy-Proven Lichen Planus of the Nails. The authors are Eric Bray and Brian Morrison from the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. They review for us that nail lichen planus is a challenging condition for both patients and clinicians. It can lead to the irreversible scarring or pterygium and also cause significant symptoms for patients. The current mainstays of treatments include intralesional, intramuscular, or systemic steroids, among others, all of which have some drawback or another in the form of pain and side effects. So enter naltrexone into the mix. Naltrexone is an opioid receptor antagonist that has been approved for treating opiate and alcohol dependence. But very interestingly, in low doses, and we're talking 1.5 to 4.5 milligrams a day, naltrexone's been shown to have anti-inflammatory effect, and it's been used off-label for various conditions like Hailey-Hailey, psoriasis, pruritus. So to first dive into why this might work for an inflammatory condition, the theory is that at low doses, naltrexone displays partial opiate receptor binding, which is followed by a paradoxical increase in endogenous opioids like beta endorphin and MET and enkephalin. So these endogenous opioids have analgesic and anti-inflammatory properties, and their expression is decreased in inflammatory conditions. Then on top of this, low-dose naltrexone has increased bindings to toll-like receptor 4, and that's associated with a decrease in pro-inflammatory cytokine production. Interestingly, it's been well documented that there's upregulated TLR4 signaling in oral lichen planus, but it's unclear about the finding in nail lichen planus. So ultimately, with all of that, these authors aim to assess the effectiveness of low-dose naltrexone for managing nail lichen planus, which has not been studied before this. They performed a retrospective case series between November 2022 and December 2023 at their hospital. All of their patients had a diagnosis of biopsy-proven nail lichen planus, and all were treated with naltrexone 3 milligrams daily as monotherapy. The outcome they followed was a change in the nail lichen planus severity index, scoring the fingernail as either clear, mild, moderate, or severe, and patients stopped treatment if they didn't have any clinical improvement after 3 months. So in the end, a total of 7 patients were included, 3 women and 4 men, and all of the patients had nail bed involvement, 6 out of 7 had nail matrix involvement. And the bottom line was that 4 out of the 7, a little over half, showed improvement, and there was an overall 35% reduction in nail lichen planus severity. No adverse events were reported, and no patients had to discontinue the therapy. Some of the patients had to stop it because of the out-of-pocket cost associated with the compounded oral preparation, and 2 of those patients developed reactivation of their nail disease after stopping it. So that kind of interesting finding lends additional support to the effectiveness of the treatment. Another interesting finding was that 2 patients who had presented with just tracheonychia as their clinical manifestation did not respond to the low-dose naltrexone. So the authors raised the question that maybe nail lichen planus with just tracheonychia could be pathologically different from typical nail lichen planus, and because it doesn't usually form pterygium and might go away on its own. And also interestingly, they noticed that most of their patients had asymptomatic Wickham striae in their buccal mucosa, and that did not go away with the treatment. So some of the patients had their nail lichen planus improved, but not the Wickham striae. So I thought this was super interesting. Not every patient responded, but with no side effects, a pretty nice option for some patients, especially when you compare it to some of the other things that we have available to us, like systemic steroids or mycophenolate. The main questions for me remaining after this paper are like what the best dose of the low dose naltrexone to try. The authors chose 3 milligrams daily because it had been previously reported to be successful for lichen planopilaris and frontal fibrosing alopecia in a prospective study. And they also noted that a recent retrospective one had shown 4.5 milligrams a day was also beneficial. And higher doses like 12.5 or 50 milligrams a day have been used successfully for Hailey-Hailey. It's not necessarily called low dose naltrexone anymore at that point. And the 50 milligrams per day is fairly easy to obtain, but those low doses, like in this study, has to be obtained from a compounding pharmacy, which is a significant hurdle for many patients and clinicians, and also adds a significant cost. Many of my patients have a pretty significant cost concern, so that would be a factor for them in deciding whether or not to use this medication, but otherwise, I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, this was a great paper, and I'm so glad that you reviewed it because I feel like I am really excited to try it. I think that there is no, I think, first line treatment for nail LP, and I think I in reading also about the side effects of this medication, what to counsel patients on. Like you say, we don't have to worry about immune suppression. There are pretty much no contraindications. I think like high doses of naltrexone are contraindicated in like hepatic failure or liver failure. But if your patient has like a mild transaminitis, you could potentially monitor and just kind of like sleep disturbances, GI symptoms. But again, things that are generally transient, reversible, or treatable. And so I agree. I think this is really exciting. And I think a lot of questions remain about dose, like you said. I also wonder if there's any benefit in considering starting the naltrexone with like a systemic steroid, maybe because we know there's such a big relapse rate, right, with steroids. So, yeah, really interesting.
That's a good point. They also seem to be hitting really different pathways in the mechanism. So whether you're thinking about doing intralesional Kenalog and something else, or if you can get a topical JAK inhibitor and maybe this as well, trying to hit it from multiple different pathways might be more beneficial than one alone.
Totally. No, it's a great paper. Awesome.
Wonderful. Well, Jasmine, tell us what you read about.
Definitely. So, on the topic of lichen planus, the paper that I'm going to be reviewing is titled Nail Lichen Planus in 81 Patients, a Retrospective Study of Clinical Characteristics, Histopathological Features, and Long-Term Treatment Outcomes. So, the name of the paper is a great summary of what to expect from the paper. It was published by Wanhe et al. And this was a retrospective study that was conducted in 81 patients. So it's a chart review study in patients that were noted to have nail lichen planus. Most of these patients had isolated nail lichen planus, but when you look at the study table, less than 10% of patients had concomitant cutaneous LP as well. So we should just note that. The patients were reviewed from June of 2016 to June of 2024 at the Department of Dermatology, First Medical Center of PLA General Hospital in Beijing, China. The inclusion criteria for this study were, I think, really important and really kind of lend a lot of credibility to this study. So all of these patients had a biopsy-proven nail lichen planus. And the biopsy technique in all these patients was a longitudinal lateral biopsy, which is something we've talked before on this podcast. But for our listeners, just to review this, this is a biopsy that basically you can imagine is kind of the equivalent of an elliptical excision of usually the lateral part of the nail. So it encompasses both the matrix, the nail bed, the nail plate, and is a really great way to diagnose inflammatory conditions because it really gives us the full picture of what's going on at each part of the nail unit. And we'll get into this further, but I think that was a really cool part of this paper. It is notable that unfortunately follow-up data wasn't present for everyone, so only 62 patients were noted to have follow-up. The average follow-up, though, for this cohort was 5 years with a confidence interval of 2.4 years, ranging from 11 months to 9 years. So I think pretty good follow-up data when we think about, like even oncologic studies, 5 years is usually the minimum. So some really interesting high-yield findings. I thought I'd summarize it kind of alongside the kind of results just to kind of make this a little bit more conversational. So the epidemiology part of this study basically characterized the kind of age and sex distribution of this patient population, and it was really compatible with prior studies. So the mean age was 44. And there was a wide range from 6 to 75 years old. There was a slight male predominance, and these are all things that have been reported before, and definitely, I think, resonate with what I see in clinic. Toenails were rarely involved, so only about 3% of cases, and a majority of patients, close to 70%, had disease only on the fingernails. What I thought was really interesting is kind of like hidden in the paper, but close to 10% of the patients had only one fingernail involved. And I think this is probably under-recognized. I certainly feel like I was always taught that, inflammatory disease, whether it's nail lichen planus or psoriasis, tends to affect more than one fingernail. But I know there was also another paper published recently looking into this single nail involvement topic. So something to keep an eye on. And now moving on to the next part. So we talked about epidemiology. So now clinical features. So in this retrospective cohort, the nail matrix findings were the most common, affecting almost 100% of cases, 97.5% of cases. And so these are findings like ridging, splitting, nail thinning, and these were the most prevalent findings. I also thought it was really interesting. The authors classified nail lichen planus into three subtypes. So we know that there are some other rare subtypes like yellow nail syndrome, like LP or blistering nail LP, but super, super rare. And so I totally agree with the authors that generally we kind of see nail lichen planus fall into one of three categories. So kind of like a classic presentation, which is usually nail matrix findings, ridging, fissuring. There's a 20 nail dystrophy, which is kind of that trichonychia, homogeneous sandpaper appearance, usually no pterygium in this subtype. And then the atrophic finding, which in my experience is really hard to treat. And we often see just thinning of the nails with variable pterygium and loss of the nail plate. Not surprising, the most common was classical. So about 70% of cases in this cohort presented classically. And I just also wanted to mention this because I know we're doing a podcast, but this paper has a great figure one, with some really beautiful clinical photos. So if our listeners are interested in kind of looking at these photos to kind of improve clinical recognition of these subtypes, I highly recommend taking a peek. Next is kind of about severity. So this is an interesting point that I don't think we has been published a lot in the literature. So kind of thinking about clinical disease severity and duration. So I should say that in terms of classifying mild, moderate, and severe, these were based on clinical subjective criteria that have been previously reported in the literature. So, as an example, mild disease was, less than 25% of nail involvement, moderate was 25 to 50%, severe was greater than 50%. There were also other criteria as well, such as nail bed findings, complete fissuring, pterygium, and those would move you into more severe categories. So, again, this is somewhat subjective, but among the patients who had basically more severity, they actually found that they had more disease duration. So 54 months versus 38 months in the less severe patients. But this did not reach statistical significance. So it's unclear if maybe this wasn't power, this we didn't have enough, or maybe this was a trend, which would kind of make sense if you have the disease ongoing longer, you have more disease severity. So that part wasn't clear. And then in terms of histology, which I again coming back to this lateral longitudinal nail biopsy, it was really interesting because the lateral nail biopsy seemed to correlate well with what we were seeing on exam. So if there were matrix findings, then there was matrix findings on the biopsy, for example. But one finding that I had never thought about before was that there was lichenoid changes in over half patients in the ventral portion of the proximal nail fold. And like essentially, AKA the cuticle, right? And what is interesting is in many of these cases, that wasn't apparent clinically. So that raises a lot of questions for me because I'm like, well, is that a good area to target for a biopsy, for example, since it's so accessible? I really liked how this paper said most people actually were pretty satisfied with the longitudinal biopsy because I think that's the biggest barrier to doing a biopsy in the first place is just the patient, being open to it, right? But even so, 14% of patients had a nail dystrophy in this paper. So, that is the downside of doing a lateral longitudinal biopsy. And I think it would be really interesting to kind of take these preliminary findings and maybe see if we can think about a less invasive form of biopsy. But just an interesting tangential point. And on the note of biopsy, when to biopsy and when to not, this is still kind of, it's never wrong to biopsy in my mind, but I think that this paper showed that close to half of patients were misdiagnosed, so 44%. And so even what might appear to be a typical case of lichen planus to one physician may not be to another. And that's why I think having a low threshold is very, very reasonable. Do you, April, biopsy all of your patients, or do you tend to reserve it for the more kind of like clinically atypical patients?
I don't biopsy all of them. I do try to have that conversation pretty early on about offering a biopsy so that a patient who, like you say, may have gone many years with misdiagnosis or unclear diagnosis has that option to get something that's a little bit more definitive for them, which I think can be really powerful. I think I have scared a patient or two away also discussing the biopsy. Some people are really disinterested in that. And so I also don't want that to be a barrier to someone receiving treatment for the condition that they most likely have. I'm aware of a few interesting mimics of lichen planus that I do always like to keep in the back of my mind, particularly if something's a little odd or a little unusual. I don't know if I've shared with you before. I think I presented at one CND meeting a case of amyloidosis that really mimicked lichen planus quite a lot. And then there's a few other things in the literature that are like that. So those are very unusual, and yet there are a lot of benefits to having a biopsy in any case. So I agree with you there.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And, I'm going to get back to this paper because I really want to talk about the treatment part of it, which is really
Yes.
cool. But I will say it is interesting going back to this paper that most patients had nail matrix findings. And I find that doing even the punch biopsy at the region of the lenula and the kind of nail bed, so getting a little bed, little matrix, tends to be really helpful, even if a patient, for example, is not as interested in doing the kind of lateral longitudinal biopsy. Maybe they're more open to that. So we have lots of options, which is great.
Yes.
Awesome. So going back to the paper, the treatment. So this is something that we all struggle with. And I think the naltrexone paper was a good kind of intro, with the caveat that naltrexone, unfortunately, was not evaluated, which makes sense because it's a new treatment option. But the biggest elephant, I think, in the room, so to say, for this paper is that there was no evaluation of any intramatrical steroid injections, which, according to the recent kind of lichen planus consensus guidelines, are, considered a first-line therapy and we all know can be effective. But with that said, the most effective treatment was IM or intramuscular and oral corticosteroids. Both methylprednisone orally was used as well as IM and seemed to be similar. But there was close to a 50% relapse rate. And I think one interesting observation was that periungual erythema produced better response rate to systemic steroids in this cohort. And I will say that's something that I will probably start looking for more meaningfully because it's not something that I think registers in my mind in terms of guiding treatment options per se. But I thought this was an interesting finding. I don't know how it affects relapse rates though, because that part wasn't sub-analyzed as far as I can tell. In terms of other treatments, the numbers were very low. So only four patients did hydroxychloroquine, no response. One patient did baricitinib. Presumably, that was refractory to other treatments. It did really well at 6 months. And then I thought the most interesting was about oral acitretin. I think this paper formalizes what I have found to be true in clinic, which is that in their cohort, of patients with more mild disease seem to respond the best. And that's my experience as well. I also want to note that one patient with more moderate severe disease did receive acitretin and did have improvement, but had to stop due to side effects. And I think that's the other challenge, as you had mentioned earlier. Some people have intolerable dryness of the skin, joint pains, or other kind of retinoid side effects that make it very challenging to have long-term treatment. And I also find relapse rates to be challenging with this as well, but this wasn't commented on in this study. So yeah, I really enjoyed reading this paper. Of course, all retrospective studies have limitations, of course, but I think as the authors state, the study really presents the longest, long, or largest, I should say, long-term cohort of biopsy-confirmed nail lichen planus to date, which I think is an accomplishment in and of itself, and I think really interesting novel findings that we kind of reviewed about biopsy techniques, proximal nail fold histological involvement, and periungual erythema. So, really enjoyed this paper.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for reviewing it in such detail. I really learned a lot there and from this paper. And I think it's a really nice companion actually to our nail lichen planus consensus guidelines, which I've read many times and refer to that paper often. I think it helps give, a little bit more numbers and data of this, large for a nail group cohort. It helps me get a little bit more granular into the data that goes into those consensus guidelines, which is why I liked it so much.
I totally agree. That's a really good point. And I think one thing that I'm really excited for and I hope for is more data on kind of combined therapies. I think that's one area where I think clinically in practice we do, but maybe we don't always report the findings. So, for example, doing steroids at the same time as acitretin or doing steroids at the same time as something else like the naltrexone that we talked about earlier. So, I think that would also be really interesting to comment on, especially with regard to relapse, because that's my biggest challenge.
Right. Yeah, say a patient does a course of systemic steroids, the relapse rate, as we see in this paper, is there. And so, yeah. How to guide a patient through all the different treatments. That would be great to see more and more papers on that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jasmine. This was a wonderful episode. Thank you to our listeners for their attention. Please share this podcast with your colleagues and trainees and let us know how we're doing and any articles you'd like us to review on the show by contacting jerry.cnd@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at Nail Disorders. The goal of the Clippings podcast is educational and informational in intent and is not a substitute or resource for formal medical advice. Listeners should not delay formal medical care for any condition or medical question they have. The views are solely those of the discussants, and use of any content is at the user's own risk.